You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Is already going full tilt boogie. There we go. I can hear myself. The battle for president of the United States is already going full tilt boogie. And we're 6 months out, I think. Let's see. June, July, August, September, October. Yeah, 6 months out. And it's like the question in my mind is this going to be, you know, premature articulation syndrome? We shall see. But the Democrats have unleashed a flurry of ads. There were two that came out of the Obama camp yesterday, a 6 minute one and a 2 minute one, web ads. You can see at barackobama.com. And now there's a 30 second ad. This is a clip eight, Jacob. The 30 second ad that has been released by the super PAC that's supporting President Obama, that I believe Paul Begala is involved with. And this is, they're all talking about the same topic, which is this steel mill that Bain Capital bought, borrowed money from a bank to buy, and then dumped the debt on the steel mill and said, okay, you guys have to pay off the debt. And, of course, that wiped them out. They had a nice profitable little business. That wiped them out. And then they drained it dry. They took the pensions of the workers. They took the pay of the workers, and ultimately they shut the thing down. And Bain Capital walked away with millions. Mitt Romney walked away with millions. This is how it works when you're a vulture capitalist. And so trying to highlight the fact that this guy's a vulture capitalist, you know, I'm wondering, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are on this. Is it way too early to begin this battle, or is it important now to do it to define the opponent? Because most of the studies show that most Americans think, oh, yeah, Mitt Romney is a successful businessman, but they have no clue what he did. They don't, you know, Bain Capital, it seems so convoluted and fancy and all this kind of stuff. Bain Capital basically did two things. Well, let me get back to that after you hear this ad. I want to set it up with the two things. The two things that they did was, one, they would occasionally invest in a business. I just throw some money in. Here's $1 million. Usually when they did that, they did it with a group of other investors. And, in fact, that's the steel company that Mitt Romney's campaign released an ad about yesterday afternoon, about the little steel company that couldn't go anywhere until finally Mitt Romney came along. Well, it turns out that Bain Capital was one of eight financiers, apparently the smallest of the eight. And they basically just threw a little bit of money in, waited 5 or 6 years, sold their stock for a profit. Now, that's good old-fashioned venture capital. That's not how Bain makes most of its money. The way that Bain makes its money is by doing something that prior to the Reagan administration was a crime. And that is borrowing money and then taking that borrowed money and buying a business and then assigning that debt to the business. It's almost like, you know, somebody coming to you and saying, I'm going to buy your house for $100,000. It's worth $100,000. Here's $100,000. And you say, great. And you say, oh, by the way, I borrowed that $100,000 from the bank. You need to pay the bank back. But when you're done paying the bank back, I own your house. You get this? This is how Bain Capital works. And this is what they did to this steel mill. So here's the story, clip 8.
With Romney and Bain Capital, the objective was to make money. Whether the companies they came in and worked with made money or not was irrelevant. Bain Capital always made money. If we lost, they made money. If we survived, they made money. It's as simple as that. He promised us the same things he's promised in the United States. He'll give you the same thing he gave us. Nothing. He'll take it all.
Priorities USA Action is responsible for the content of this advertising.
And that's from the Super PAC Priorities USA Action. And I think it's just fascinating that this, you know, will the American people, is this too sophisticated for people to get? Is this too fancy? Is there too much subtlety to it? That's the bet that the Republicans are making. That's the bet they made during the Republican primaries. You know, Newt Gingrich and Rick Santorum both came out and attacked Mitt Romney for running Bain. or for the way that Bain operated, because it's not a venture capital firm. It's not like, you know, some rich guy who loans you $1 million to start a business. It's not that at all. This is a pump and dump shop. This is a chop shop. Or at least most of what they do, the most profitable things that they do, are buying businesses and then giving the business the debt, have the business pay off the debt, and then they still own the business. And if the business fails, as the steel mill did, then they declare bankruptcy on behalf of the business, and they don't have to pay back. Bain doesn't have to pay back the debt. The debt's been assigned to the business. The business goes bankrupt. The debt goes away. Bain already took their millions of dollars in commissions and fees. They're happy. So what if 600 people are out of work? Or 1,000 or 2,000 or 5,000? Yeah, so what? That's the attitude over at Bain. So here you've got this guy, Mitt Romney. There was a particularly fascinating article today. It's over at alternet.org right now. About how empathy, they were looking specifically at men, and they did a test of their empathy, their ability to identify with others, and then they asked them how strongly they were interested in politics. And what they found was that men who had a lot of empathy, who were capable of understanding how other people feel and actually feeling what the other people felt, people who would look at a picture of a person in pain and have a twinge, right? Have a sense of that pain. If they were very interested in politics, they were very, very liberal. But the men who had almost no empathy, very little empathy, who didn't have the ability to relate to their fellow man or woman, or for that matter, animals in pain, those people who had very little empathy, if they were really interested in politics, they were consistently conservatives. So there's a couple of questions here. Is the bet that Mitt Romney's making right now and that the Republican Party is making, and they've been making this bet for 3 years, is the bet that these conservatives who don't go along with, who don't experience empathy, that they're going to say, psh, so what? Some people lost their jobs. Romney made some money. That's the important thing. He helped the economy. That's the important. You get it? They're making the bet that people are not going to get that there's a human dimension to these things, at least the conservative base, because they lack empathy. That's why they're conservatives. And this is the bet that they made when they said, you know, a year ago or 6 months ago when they said to the president, oh, you want to extend unemployment benefits for another 99 weeks? No. We'll go to 53 weeks. And the Democrats compromised at 70, whatever it is, 73, 76 weeks. And so last weekend, you had hundreds of thousands of people, literally 200,000 Americans just lost their unemployment benefits. Why? Because these Republicans in the House of Representatives and the Senate who are unable to feel empathy. There's a word for this, by the way. It's called being a sociopath. These Republicans in the House and Senate who are unable to feel empathy thought, hey, let's do this. If we don't do this, we're going to have to raise taxes on rich people. That was the president's proposal. Remember, raise taxes on people who earn over $1 million a year on their million and first dollar. He said, no, we can't do that. Might cause a little pain. But actually, that's not even empathy, because they know that there's not real pain associated with having to pay an extra 2 or 3 or 4% income tax on your first dollar after you made a million. And you're still paying less than 35% or less than 40%. This is nuts. So what's the bet here that the Republicans are laying down?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Is it that they're assuming that most Americans aren't paying attention? Or is it that they're assuming that most Americans are sociopaths just like them? Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Ernie in Bishop, California. Hey, Ernie, your thoughts on all this?
Romney's businesses.
Ernie, I'm sorry. Hang on just a minute. Let me put you on hold here. Senator Bernie Sanders is on the line with us. Senator Sanders.
Good. Hey, how are you, Tom?
Great. Great to have you with us. I understand that there was a summit party on Monday and a rally that you were at, and I wanted to get you on to tell us about it.
Well, what happened today was that Pete Peterson, who you know is a billionaire who made his money on Wall Street, he has been on a crusade for a number of years to figure out ways to cut Social Security and Medicare and Medicaid. And he is spending a huge amount of money in that effort. And one of the things that he did today was to hold a major conference, which included a lot of Republican leaders. I think John Boehner was there, Paul Ryan was there, as well as some Democrats. I think President Clinton was there. And I myself, at a rally afterwards, with the National Organization of Women and the National Committee to Preserve Social Security and Medicare and the National Campaign for National Priorities, I mean, our position was that it is morally obscene for a billionaire with more money than he's going to be spending in 100 lifetimes to be telling working families who are struggling to keep their heads above water that, sorry, their Medicaid and their Medicare and their Social Security and their educational programs the federal government now provides have got to be cut. So this is the old Robin Hood proposal in reverse. You have billionaires who want more tax breaks for themselves, and at the same time want to pay for those tax breaks by cutting programs for people who are just barely surviving right now. And I think at a time when this country has such a terribly unequal distribution of wealth and income, we have the top 400 wealthiest people in this country, I suspect including Mr. Peterson, owning more wealth than the bottom half of America, 150 million people. Billionaires should not be attacking working families and lower income people. That is just morally objectionable, plus the fact it's terrible economics. We've got to put more money into the hands of working families. We got to create millions of jobs. That's how you grow the economy, and that's, in fact, how you deal with the deficit.
Yeah, absolutely. Pardon me for putting this in yesterday. My notes are wrong here. I thought it was today, and then in any case. So one of the talking points that came out of this thing is the Simpson Bowles. My recollection, Bernie, and please correct me if I'm wrong on this too. My recollection is that good progressives like Jan Schakowsky on the Simpson Bowles Commission basically blew it up, and they were never able to issue a final report.
No, that's correct.
And so, Mr. Simpson and Mr. Bowles issued an unofficial report that said, "Okay, yeah, let's cut Social Security and keep the tax breaks for millionaires and billionaires." But everybody in the media refers to that as the Simpson Bowles report. I don't get it.
Well, you're right. The Simpson-Bowles report was not passed, but it is being used as a document and an architecture for more austerity on middle-income and working families. You know, Tom, what I find really quite incredible is every poll that I have seen says, you know what, Social Security is of vital importance to over 50 million Americans. Social Security is not going broke. It can pay out every benefit owed to every eligible American for the next 22 years. Has a $2.7 trillion surplus. For the American people, whether you're Democrat, Independent, Republican, don't cut Social Security. And then on the other hand, when people, as they do, understand that the wealthiest people in America are becoming much richer, that you have a situation now where almost all of the new income created in America, last report that we saw, 2010, 93% of all new income created in America went to the top 1%. So rich are getting richer. When all the, you know, with overwhelming numbers of Americans say, yeah, we want to deal with the deficit, there's got to be austerity for the wealthy and large corporations and not simply for the middle class and working families and lower income people. And yet you got a conference today, which is where I spoke at the rally outside of that conference, which is essentially conniving ways, coming up with ways to make life more difficult for the middle class, which is already being hurt so badly today. And we've got to fight that as strongly as we can.
Yeah, absolutely. And good on you. Where does this go? What's next now? The rally's over.
Here's where it goes. I mean, what this guy, Peterson, and he's just one of many. He's just a billionaire who's devoted to cutting Social Security and other important programs. Where it goes, and let me be very frank about this. During the election period, I don't think you're going to see much. But I think the day after the election, frankly, no matter who is elected, Romney or Obama, I think you're going to see Republicans and Democrats sitting down and say, okay, let's do it. let's start cutting Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid.
Yikes.
And what I am suggesting now is the American people have got to make this a campaign issue. And when you see a candidate out there who's running for office, you ask them that question, are you going to cut Social Security? Are you going to vote to do that? Even when it has a $2.7 trillion surplus and hasn't contributed a nickel to the deficit, are you going to cut Medicare when so many older people today are struggling despite Medicare paying their health care bills? Are you really going to do that? Or are you going to fight for deficit reduction in a way that's fair? Are we going to cut military spending, which is now, we're now spending more than the rest of the world combined? Are you going to do away with all of these corporate loopholes, which in some cases enable companies like ExxonMobil in a given year to make billions in profits and not pay a nickel in federal income tax? Are you going to do away with that? Are you going to go after the wealthiest people in this country who are now paying the lowest effective tax rates in decades while they're getting richer? Are you going to ask them? So there are ways to do deficit reduction. There are ways to invest in our infrastructure, in our energy system, to create jobs. But the way you do that is by asking the wealthy and large corporations and the military-industrial complex to also undergo some austerity, and you don't simply keep attacking working families who are being decimated during this recession.
Yeah, brilliantly said. Senator Sanders, thank you so much for being with us today.
Good to be here.
Keep it up. Okay. Thank you very much, Bernie. And just to bring this back, we just have about a minute, just a few seconds here before we're gonna bail out of this segment. Well, in fact, there's the music. But I just wanted to bring this back to this question that we'll address right after the break. We can pick up your calls on, of is the Romney campaign appealing to the people among us who have no empathy? Are they appealing to the sociopaths among us? Are they just assuming that people aren't paying attention, or are they assuming that vulture capitalism is so complex, the average American can't figure it out?
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Your call's right after this, 27 minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program. You can drop into our live chat room, by the way, and hang out in the conversation, tomhartman.com. It's free. Occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. And Carol in Charlestown, New Hampshire. Hey, Carol, what's up?
Hey, Tom, I listen to you all the time, and you're exactly right about everything about Romney. I'm from Massachusetts originally, and I know Romney was my governor.
Mm-hmm.
And everything they say about Romney, he's all for himself, he's all for the rich. That's exactly true. And if he gets in, this country is going to go through such a hell, I can't even imagine what's going to happen, because I know Romney like a book. He's all for himself. The only thing he's interested in is money. And people think that just because they're offered another candidate in this country, it's just like you said, they don't check out what the guy is all about.
Right.
They assume because, oh, Obama's not doing that good in the economy. Well, I think he's doing fantastic considering what he's inherited, because at first I wanted Hillary Clinton to get in. I thought she had more experience, but then I've been checking out all Obama's did, and I can see that he's done very well.
Yeah.
considering
that the Republicans have thwarted half his efforts and they're hell-bent for leather. I mean, John Boehner now is saying that he wants to, as the debt ceiling needs to be raised, he wants to use this to lay off another 1.8 million people. And, I mean, they are so committed. Carol, thank you for the call, and thanks for your thoughts. They are so committed to crashing this economy, and as Mitch McConnell said, the Republicans in the Senate, their first job is not to make jobs for people, not to create an economy that works, but to make sure that the President of the United States is a one-term president. I find that pretty astounding. Bob, in Brooklyn, New York, listening on WWRL. Hey, Bob, what's up?
Hi there, Tom. I'm so glad you're on live here now.
Yeah, thank you. Me too.
New York, New York, a place so nice we named it twice.
Yeah.
I listen to your show just about every day. And, you know, the question is, I think you raised before, who is Mitt Romney appealing to? Now, I've heard you in the past trying to, you know, interviewing some of these Tea Party types, asking them, well, how come you don't join us in opposing kind of the system, a political system that empowers Wall Street, et cetera, and big business? Now, I've been involved in local Democratic Party politics here. I've been campaigning a lot lately for the Democrats. This is a place, Brooklyn, New York, where Democrats outnumber Republicans about 5 or 6 to 1, and the Democrats are taking a beating. We've lost 2 congressional elections for House of Representatives, state Senate elections we're losing. These are working-class Democrats voting Republican. They'll tell me they're registered Democrats. I know they are, and they're voting Republican. They sympathize with the Tea Party. They raise the Tea Party flag, literally. And a lot of these people are government workers, union members. And I ask them, why? You're voting against your own interests with regard to Social Security? Aren't you worried about Medicare being privatized? And they say anything the Republicans are for, it must be good for me, they say.
Yeah.
I said, but what is going on? They keep talking about Mexicans getting everything, immigrants.
Yeah.
Everything.
It's all about, oh, my God, those brown people.
Yeah, I mean, and we
It used to be that what they said was, oh, my God, those black people. It's like, I suppose that's progress, but I don't think so, actually.
My state senator is a Republican who also runs on a New York State Conservative Party.
Yeah.
His name is Marty Golden. Okay, now, I've gone to his town hall meetings, and the people are asking him for services. They're frustrated. The streets are in poor condition, Senator, state senator. The education is terrible. The transportation is terrible. They want services, and yet they keep thanking him and kissing his rear end, saying, oh, you're so good to us. You're always there for us. You're always fighting for us. Yet they'll vote for a conservative, and he's also a Tea Party-type person.
Yeah.
And then it's always the same. They seem to feel the Republican Party protects everything they have, even their entitlement programs, their Social Security, their Medicare. They feel the Republicans are protecting them from the Democrats who want to take away everything they have and give it to immigrants and minorities.
Yeah, when the reality is not that at all. The reality is that the Republicans want to take it away from them and give it to Wall Street banksters. And the percentage of the economy that is going to immigrants and to minorities and to welfare programs and poverty is minuscule. It's such a tiny fragment of what we spend on, for example, defense, or even what we spend on subsidizing the oil companies. It's astounding that they're able to get away with that. So you were going to make a point, Bob.
Yeah, I mean, these people just don't seem to care. And I'm wondering if the Democrats are just hitting the wrong chords on the octave.
I think the problem is that the Republicans are willing to lie, and the Democrats, by and large, have not been willing to lie. And I think that this goes back – thanks for the call, Bob. I think this goes back to that original thing that I laid out, that there's an actual physical, biological, neurological difference between conservatives and liberals, and that is that liberals score high on empathy and conservatives score – radically below the average on empathy. And you know, empathy being the ability to understand how another person experiences the world. And it's really quite extraordinary. John in Santa Cruz, California. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom. So I think I got a handle on this, man. Mm-hmm. And as a progressive, I think it's actually us that are outside of the norm. Mitt Romney's a wolf, and he's doing what wolves do. And as progressives, I feel sometimes like we fight wolves by throwing Halloween candy at them. It's the most scary thing we got, but it tastes good, right?
Well, I think the strategy up to this point, by and large, has not been to fight the wolves. It's been to try to corral or get together all the people and say, hey, we're all in this together. We need to defend ourselves. And the people don't get it. They don't get that the wolves are coming after them, because the wolves are literally, not literally, but the wolves are metaphorically dressed like sheep. I mean, Mitt Romney's, his whole shtick is, I'm just a friendly, average guy. Forget the fact that, you know, last year I made $20 million. I'm just an average, friendly guy. And, you know, laughs and chuckles a lot and does pranks on people, you know, like cutting gay guys' hair and stuff like that. But, you know, that.
What about the notion that progressives are kind of swimming upstream, and that we kind of exist in the reverberation of religious dogma, because care for other isn't necessarily a natural trait.
Actually, I think it is. I think that empathy is wired into us, and I think that a lack of empathy. There was an interesting piece in the New York Times last week about can a 9-year-old be a psychopath? And, you know, about these children who have this detachment disorder, this lack of connection. And, John, thank you for the call. And I think that there's biology. I think there's nature as well as nurture. I think that they're both there. Clifford in Ishpeming, Michigan. Hey, Clifford, thanks for calling. What's up?
Well, along them same lines is that the last two callers have been talking about. I listened to you talking to Bernie Sanders. And, you know, I'm starting to have a problem. I've been a Democrat all my life, and I'm 74 years old. I've voted in every election since I've been 21. And, you know, I'm starting to, I hate to say this, but I listen to these things that you say are happening. And I'm not saying they're not happening. But, you know, if everything that you're, that, and I'm glad I'm listening to it, okay? But, you know, that's the only place you hear it. CNN is probably the only other one that ever comes up with anything that goes on besides this stuff. There's never any facts. All these little laws, or I shouldn't say little laws, nobody ever knows about them.
Yeah.
CNN put on a thing. I go to Florida during the winters, and I was in Florida, and I think that was in about the 1st of March, where they actually gave some figures as to what Obamacare was going to do, who was going to pay what, and so forth.
Right.
Now, people give money to the Democratic Party. They give money to their campaigners. As far as I'm concerned, they're wasting it, because they should be, if they have to pay for the ads, pay for them. Forget about some of the stuff they say. Let's get down to some of the stuff that's actually going on.
Yeah.
And
okay.
If we
all
have
right.
To pay for it. Fine.
Clifford, I really think. Thank you for the call. I really think we're talking about what's actually going on, and I want to talk more about it. And I agree that the mainstream media is not talking about it, and that's one of the big problems that we have in the United States, frankly. Lois in Gardenia, California. Hey, Lois, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good.
I just, a few weeks ago, I think you were talking about agrarian justice, Thomas Paine.
Yes, one of Thomas Paine's least known and most brilliant works.
I went back and read it because I think in my youth I probably skipped right over it.
Most people do.
But I think everyone should read this.
Yeah, it's like a little 60-page booklet. I mean, it's not a big tome.
It's not, but it, I was struck by the part about how no one accumulates wealth without society.
Yes.
And, but then after hearing Bernie Sanders just a few minutes ago, I thought of the other part about how the accumulation of personal property is generally the effect of paying too little for labor. Mm-hmm. Then when the laborer gets old, he's used up, and the owner, the employer, has amassed all this wealth.
Right, and that's the story of Mitt Romney and Bain Capital.
Yeah,
and the workers that they kicked to the curb. I mean, you know,
exactly.
It's like, what do you do with your slaves? What do you do with your workers? What do you do with your employee? You know, when they're no longer needed. Well, in the Republican universe, you just discard them. I mean, it was like the question put to Ron. I don't know. Maybe that's too harsh, you know. But to say, you know, what do you do if a guy is dying in the street? And you know, Ron Paul's people were yelling, "Let him die." Ron Paul was trying to waffle on that, you know, calling the churches or something. But anyhow, Lois, thank you for the call. Excellent point.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The book that Lois was talking about was written by Thomas Paine, and it's called Agrarian Justice. Brilliant.
They want to get my gold on the ceiling. I ain't lying, just a matter of time.
Talk media for the sane among us, the Tom Hartman Radio and TV program. Welcome back. Cody in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Cody, what's up?
Hey, Tom, great show today.
Thank you. What's on your mind?
Listen, you know, the main thing with the Romney campaign is I just find it to be such a joke. I mean, the guy is a complete empty suit. He never knows what he stands for.
Well, okay, you believe that, but right now the polls are showing Romney actually a couple of points ahead of Obama in national matchup.
No,
how
I know.
How do you
count it? No, I'm not feeling good about that, you know, because I'm part of We Are Change here in San Antonio. We've been working with Occupy San Antonio. We've kind of come up with this new idea of Occupy Bilderberg. Have you ever heard about Bilderberg, Tom?
Oh, yeah, yeah, the boys' club. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And you know, they're meeting here May 31st to June 3rd in Virginia, of all places.
Oh, interesting. Okay. So you're of the opinion, Cody, that Romney's an empty suit. What are you going to do about that?
Well, I think we need to start, you know, protesting in the streets and just getting out there and getting active, awakening the public to the fact that, I mean, Romney's really, if the conservatives like Romney so much, and they're going to go with him against Obama. I don't see how they realize that he's any different than Obama at the end of the day.
Yeah, well, I think he's considerably different from Obama. Obama does not want to have more wars. Obama doesn't want to perpetuate this low taxation for multimillionaires and billionaires. In fact, on several occasions, he's proposed raising the taxes on them to pay for social programs. Romney wants to do the exact opposite. Respectfully, I'd say there's some radical differences between the two, Cody. I'm with you. Romney's an empty suit. James in Atlanta, Georgia. Hey, James.
Hey, Tom. I listen to you a lot. I can't say that I agree very, very often at all, but I did want to voice my opinion on the Social Security disinformation campaign that seems to be prevalent on the left, the right, the independents, and everyone else, that Social Security...
I don't think it's present on the left. I think that this is purely coming out of the right that is funded by the banksters saying that Social Security is broke or going broke. It's nonsense.
It is when the left says that the right is trying to take Social Security, but... Nobody
they absolutely are. George W. Bush was so upfront about this. George W. Bush, over and over and over again, came in 1997. Excuse me, in 1970, what was it, 77? I'd have to go back and look at the year. In any case, when he ran for Congress, when George W. Bush ran for Congress, his one issue was turning Social Security over to the bankers on Wall Street. It was privatizing Social Security. After the 2004 election, remember that speech he gave? He said, I'm going to spend some of my political capital on privatizing Social Security? Come on, give me a break. This is like saying the war on women was invented by Democrats. Nonsense. The Republicans are actually even using that language. The war on Social Security is just at its root in the Republican Party. Deep. Steve in North Troy, Vermont. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Greetings from the home of the Northern Lights.
Thank you.
I was trying to find the nexus of greed, you know, like when it became okay to be like Christian and greedy at the same time. And it seems to point back to the 20s when there were so many copies of the Bible going around that a group of pastors decided to copyright the Bible. And that's when you started seeing the change from forgive us our debts to forgive us our trespasses, which has absolutely nothing to do with, the Old Testament Jubilee, the forgiveness of debts every generation, stuff like that.
Yeah, every 7 years, all debt was forgiven in the Old Testament.
Yeah, and that's where we get the thing on the Liberty Belt, proclaim liberty throughout the land. That was from the Jubilee.
Whoa.
On the 49th or 50th year.
Right, on the 50th year, all the slaves were freed, everything was equalized, the wealth was totally redistributed, and society economically was completely rebooted. And this is all Old Testament stuff. Oh, that's fascinating.
Yeah, but it goes back.
But you say the 1920s. I would say, the 1880s. The 1880s was the rise of the robber barons. And they tried to cloak much of what they were doing in Christianity. In fact, there was a huge religious revival in the United States in the 1880s, 1890s. A number of religions that are kind of unique to America, the Seventh-day Adventists, the Mormons, the Jehovah's Witnesses, they all came out during that period of time. They were all brought about or started really significantly growing during that robber baron era. And
think about the Roaring Twenties, though.
I think that that's just the cycle. I think the robber baron era came along. They got too much power and wealth. They crashed the economy with the Great Depression of 1897, as I recall it was.
Well, that's why the traditional haunted houses always look Victorian. You know, there was a crash and there was so much empty housing around that that the mansard roof and, the Adams family type house became the haunted house.
Oh, interesting. Interesting. I'm telling you, I've got the smartest listeners on earth. Steve,
I just got a good memory, that's all.
Okay. Thanks a lot for the call, Steve. I appreciate it. Joe in Nebraska, excuse me.
Cozad, Nebraska, yes.
Cozad.
Joe.
Thank you, Joe. What's up?
Tom, thank you for your beautiful show program that you put up. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
The question I wanted to bring up, Tom, that they will not mention on any of the main news channels regarding this venture capital. Because whenever venture capital comes in, they buy up everything, they strip it clean, and they sell out everything that they can make a profit of. And ultimately, the workers go on
unemployment or welfare.
Unemployment. Yeah.
What you're describing, though, Joe,
about this,
What you're describing is not venture capital. What you're describing is Bain-style vulture capitalism. That's what Bain does. And it used to be illegal before the Reagan administration to buy a company with debt and have the company pay off the debt, and then you still own the company. It used to be that you bought a company, you owned it. But if you borrowed the money, you were responsible for the debt, not the company. And, you know, the rules got changed in the 80s, and that allowed for Bain Capital's business model to exist. Mitt Romney, you know, made $20 million last year doing something that historically was illegal.
But how come none of the main news channels ever mention about this, Tom?
I think that there's a conspiracy of silence. I don't think that the big news media, they're so worried about being criticized, particularly by Republicans. They need these big names on their shows. If they don't get the big names on their shows, they don't compete well against the stations that do. It's the only thing I can come up with, Joe, because this is not a secret. It's not a secret. In fact, it's right there in Obama's ad. You know, so much that it's not a secret. And yet you will hear no discussion of this in the media. Joe, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm here with you, and Carrie Lucas with the Independent Women's Forum is on the line with us and on Skype as well. Hey, Carrie.
Hey, how are you?
I am fine. Welcome back to the program. I'm curious, I wanted to talk with you about this co-founder of Facebook, Eduardo Saverin, I believe his name is pronounced.
Yeah.
And this is a guy who came to the United States in 1992 from Brazil. His family is very, very wealthy. In fact, Mark Zuckerberg thought he was involved with the Brazilian mafia. They went to school together at Harvard. He put up the $15,000 that was used to start Facebook. He became a citizen in 98, and then he left the country apparently a couple of years ago, moved to Singapore, where he's been living full time. And sometime during this last year, we're not really sure when, gave up his U.S. citizenship. He's not saying anything. In fact, part of the court settlement in his lawsuit against Zuckerberg and against Facebook was that he would not talk to the press anymore. So nobody really knows why he gave up his U.S. citizenship. And that's what I find so fascinating about this, is it's become a kind of a Rorschach test for all the rest of us. It looks to me like he just, you know, he had a very, very tenuous relationship with the United States that mostly was involved around his being here going to college. And, you know, he's living full time in Singapore, likes it there. But the people on the conservatives are saying, oh, he's doing it because he'll pay lower taxes in Singapore, or he won't have to pay taxes on his Facebook earnings. Although it turns out that he's going to have to pay taxes on his Facebook earnings. So what's going on here?
Well, you know, I think that it actually matters very little. This is one of those, what lesson are you going to draw from this? This particular case of whether this guy is going to owe taxes and how much he owes is really not the point. I think the real question here is, how do people act when tax laws change? And I think the lesson in all of this is that tax laws matter, and very few people pay higher taxes than they have to out of a sense of patriotism. Even guys like Warren Buffett, who talk a lot about wanting to be taxed more, when at the end of the day they use fancy lawyers and try their very best to minimize their tax liabilities. And that's really what this is about. I don't think this guy is a hero. He's just somebody acting in his own self-interest, and Americans should be warned that that's what the people do.
Forbes is calling him a hero. But if that's what rich people do, if they just say, to hell with the country that, I mean, you know, frankly, Facebook would not have been able to make a penny if it wasn't for the Internet. The Internet was created originally as DARPANET. It was created with U.S. taxpayer dollars. We built the infrastructure for the Internet that made Mark Zuckerberg and Eduardo Saverin billionaires. And for them to not pay back on that just seems churlish.
But, you know, Tom, I think that you're making the mistake to think that, that people assume that giving taxes is somehow a noble cause, and that people in Washington are so smart about what they're going to be doing with those money that when I pay taxes, I'm doing good. No, a lot of guys out there, and I assume that Mr. Buffett faces the same logic, think, well, you know, if I keep this money, I'm going to do much better things with it. It's going to be better for the country, better for poor people.
Well, I disagree, and I think a lot of people disagree, Carrie. I just, you know, on its face, there's, and I know that Warren Buffett would disagree with that. We need the commons not to be in the hands of greedy private corporations or people like Mitt Romney. We need the commons to be in the hands of we the people. And frankly, we don't know why Eduardo Severin is leaving, but the question I'd ask you is, where, you know, I don't recall in the 19-teens when the income tax rate in the United States went from basically nothing all the way up to 91% as we went into World War One. I don't recall the Rockefellers or the Morgans or the DuPonts or the Fairchilds or the Goulds, the railroad fortunes. I don't recall any of them saying, "To hell with it, I'm out of here, I'm leaving my country." I don't. And then the tax rate got dropped when Harding came into office in 21 from 91% down to 25%. Stayed there until the Great Crash in 29. Roosevelt took it back up to 91% again. And again, I don't remember an exodus of billionaires. Why is it that this generation is so much more greedy, selfish, and self-centered and doesn't give a rat's ass about their nation, and whereas previous generations of very wealthy people had that sense of noblesse oblige, the sense that they actually do owe something back to the country that made them so rich?
Well, you know, I think there's a lot of reason we could talk about what's wrong with young people today as much as we want, but the simple fact of why more people are changing their tax jurisdictions is because they can. It doesn't matter. We all know we are an increasingly
They could in 1880.
Global war. No, Tommy, but if you were going to go someplace else, you then couldn't participate in the American economy. You can run a business, you can do, you can enjoy a lot of the things that used to be just limited to one country much better now wherever you are overseas.
So your argument is that they're doing it now because they can.
Because they can, absolutely. And,
Isn't it kind of tragic?
No, I don't, because I don't think it's crazy to want to keep more of your money. And
even if you have billions?
I think
how much is enough,
billions,
Carrie?
If you have billions,
this guy's going to have $3.8 billion.
That's fine.
And he might save a couple $100 million in taxes. This
sure,
is money that he'll never even, I mean, you got $3 billion. You couldn't, if you were spending it at the rate of $1 million a day, it would take several lifetimes to spend.
But Tom, then what's the government going to do with it? We now see what the trash.
They're going to educate the kids that are using your product.
They're going to go take it. We've seen how government goes and takes it to Vegas and has clowns and entertainers come for boondoggle vacations. We see all of the
fact that
the
you guys were able to bust the which agency was it that did that?
That was the GSA.
GSA. You guys were able to bust the GSA for doing something which is absolutely routine in corporate America. I don't hear any outrage from you or any of your peers about the fact that the very same thing is being done by our health insurance companies.
But that's their money. This is our money. That's the problem with tax money.
Well, except for the fact that I think that when the health insurance companies take my money, it's still my money.
But Tom, it's only the health insurance is a.
But the fact that the fact that you busted those guys from the GSA proves, and it's not going to happen again, and people lost their jobs over it, proves that government can be responsive to we the people when they get out of line.
It's because
that's a good
like
thing.
No, but things go on like that all the time. We know from the Soliandra case where you had government giving $500 million or whatever it was to a company just because it has political connections. This happens all the time.
Well, I believe that that's a false stipulation, Carrie. Soliandra is nowhere near that simple.
Okay.
It's been turned into that kind of right wing talking point, but. I'm guessing you haven't seriously investigated that.
No, I haven't. I've read the newspapers, Tom, and I think you know as well as I do that there's tremendous amounts of corporate welfare of people who are giving away the government.
So let's stop giving money away to the oil industry. Why is it that every single Republican in the House and Senate wants to keep the oil industry subsidized in place?
Let's let's stop giving away from all of them. And one, we can make the tax code transparent, lower the rates, get rid of all the deductions, and let's stop with programs like Saliandra, which picks one company that happens to have great political connections.
But when you have Carrie, let me push back on that. When you have a situation where our sovereignty is in the hands of the Saudis, I think it's a good thing to subsidize companies like Saliandra. And you're going to have some failures, but at least you take a chance and you try to say, you know, we don't want to be beholden to Saudi Arabia anymore.
You know what, Tom? There'll be
What's
a million
wrong with
better.
That?
Because it doesn't end up. It never ends up as clean as that. Because we all know
it did.
It doesn't surprise anyone in America that everybody who gets the money in from those programs ends up being somebody who's given political donations.
It worked out well when we built the internet. Worked out well when we electrified America. It worked out well when the Rural Telephony Administration put telephone lines across the United States. I mean, I think it could work out well if we built out a solar infrastructure.
Oh, we'll see. I think American people are going to see a lot of money go down the drain before we reach any of those goals.
Well, and I suspect most of it's going to go down the drains in the pockets of the CEOs of the health insurance companies. My personal obsession. Carrie Lucas with the Independent Women's Forum, IWF.org is the website. Carrie, thank you again for being here.
Great, thanks for having me on.
Always good talking to you. 15 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So what is the bet that the Republicans are making? Are they figuring that people just aren't paying attention, or are they figuring that people will, you know, I don't quite get it.
That ain't working, that's the way you do it. Money for nothing and the chips free. That ain't working, that's the way you do it.
20 minutes past the hour, welcome back. Don in Wausau, Wisconsin. Hey, Don, what's up? Don, you are on the air. Okay, Don's not there. Sam in Rolla, Missouri. Hey, Sam, what's up?
Yes. Hi. You know, I think in 2008, everyone thought that he was going to be like a super FDR.
Obama. Yeah.
Yeah, he was going to have...
Well, not everyone. I've said many times, I think that President Obama in the 2008 election was kind of the national Rorschach test, the inkblot test, because what happened was because his campaign was sufficiently vague that conservatives looked at him and said, oh my God, he's going to be a communist. And liberals looked at him and said, you know, maybe he's going to be FDR. And really, you know, he was kind of more like Bill Clinton.
Because everyone ran to vote for that. A big stimulus, like 10 times the size that he did, like tax the rich, public option. They fantasized that was going to happen.
Well, they also fantasized that could pass through Congress. That's one of the problems, is that the president can't create laws. Congress has to create laws. And, go ahead.
But there's coattails. And in other words, in 2010, they painted him as the guy who was redistributing wealth.
Right. You know, the Republicans did.
Yeah. He was giving away the Medicare to minorities. So they killed the Democrats. Now, if he comes out now with a super FDR program, there'll be coattails, and maybe he'll get the Congress back, too.
I agree. I think that that's what it's going to take. I think that President Obama has to become FDR either now or after the election, and I think if he doesn't do it now, he won't win the election. And, Sam, thanks a lot for the call. I'm totally with you on this. Scott in Spokane, Wisconsin, or Washington, rather. Hey, Scott, what's up? Scott?
Yeah, hey, Tom. How you doing?
Hey, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Great. I just got back from basket ride. Feels great. Hey, was this we're talking about this earlier today, but you know, there's a lot of people, you know, nonprofits taking money from the government, you know, millions of dollars a year, and you know, it seems like they kind of overpay their CEOs and their whatever, you know, the guys at the top, and it's pretty hard to see how we can, as a people, can control that because the government's not trying it.
Well,
you know?
We can. The way that we do it is we stop the process of money cycling from companies who benefit from government policies, whether it's directly benefiting because they're being paid or indirectly benefiting because the government policies change the tax code or something like that, from companies that benefit from government policies or regulatory policies, giving money to politicians and then those politicians giving legal favors to those companies. We need to break that cycle. And the problem is that cycle has been established by the United States Supreme Court. It's been established, you know, over 100 years. And it reached its peak with Citizens United. And in order to break that, we need to do away with those dual doctrines that corporations are people and that money is speech. And until we do that, we're going to have this problem of having a corrupted government. We have, and thank you for the call, Scott, but basically what we have in the United States right now is an oligarchy. We have rule by the very rich and powerful. And they can buy the best government money can buy. And we need to take that back. And there's still a window. It's still possible. But I'm telling you, if this Citizens United election that's coming up, where, you know, $2-4 billion gets spent by multi-billionaires on electing corporate shills to office, if that's what happens, and there's nobody left to speak for us, you know, it's the Pastor Niemöller. You know, he's the famous guy who in the 1930s said, you know, first they came for the communists, and I was not a communist, and I did not protest. And then they came for the trade unionists, and I was not a trade union. And then they came for the Jews, and I was not a Jew. And then finally, you know, then they came for the ministers. They came for the preachers, and there was no one left to defend me. This is that kind of Pastor Niemöller moment. I believe that democracy itself is hanging in the balance. Bob in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Bob, what's up?
How are you doing today?
Good.
Question about this Bain Capital with Romney. Mm-hmm. Was there ever a figure that was thrown out there? Like, how many jobs were affected?
Romney's campaign during the primaries was claiming that he created hundreds of thousands of jobs. Now they're claiming that he's created thousands of jobs. They've changed their language. And nobody really knows, because to the best of my knowledge, nobody has gone company by company during the time that Romney was at Bain or all the deals that Romney's fingerprints were on and did a net assessment. And also, you know, these companies have a habit of saying, well, we created 100,000 jobs and 90,000 of them were in China. But, hey, we created the jobs, and so they take credit for that. It's like, you know, the big business in America over the last 15 years has net created something like 4, 5, 6 million jobs. I forget the number. We had it here in the show about 3 months ago. We did a thing on it. And it turns out that U.S. jobs, they've actually wiped out over a million. But all these jobs that they've created have been overseas. So, frankly, with regard to Bain Capital, I don't think anybody knows. What we do know is that when they invested in companies like Staples or like, you know, the steel company that the Romney ad is running, where they just did basic good old-fashioned venture capital. Here's $1 million, go make some money, guys. And those people go out and make some money, and then they, you know, they own a piece of stock. They did okay, as venture capitalists do, and they created jobs. But when they did what Bain Capital was really incorporated to do, what its principal function, which is to buy existing, in many cases, very healthy companies, and then load them with the debt from the purchase. In other words, borrow all the money to buy them, load them with that debt, take 20% off the top as a commission at the moment they buy it. So it's profitable from day one. And then either strip that company down and wring as much money out of it as possible, drive it into bankruptcy as they did with the steel mill that the president is highlighting in his ad. Or if it's possible to build the company up to profitability and then sell it off, never having to pay a penny on that debt. They make massive profits, absolutely massive profits, doing something that would have been illegal before Ronald Reagan became president and changed the rules. And okay. That's what people need to figure out, in my opinion.
Okay. Now, I mean, your opinion, do you think that number would be more or less than the amount of jobs that Obama lost when he kicked all the employees from the dealership that he closed down to the curb?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. And I think that, you know, kicking a few dealers to the curb and saving an entire industry is better than doing what Romney wanted to do, which was kick all the dealers to the curb and wipe out the entire industry.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
But maybe I'm missing something. I really don't think so. It really astounds me, the number of Romney apologists who call in. It just astounds me. No, you would have, if you had $1 million, you would have about 3 weeks worth of income from Mitt Romney. Yeah, no, I'm not making that up. It's pretty amazing. It's pretty amazing when you consider it. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. Monica in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hey, Monica, what's up?
I was curious about something. I know that Michelle Bachmann recently left the country to get Swiss citizenship.
She came back, though, and she has renounced her Swiss citizenship. She got a lot of blowback in her district from that.
Huh. Yeah. Well, why would she do it in the first place?
Well, I think her husband, Marcus, both his parents are Swiss. They're from Switzerland, and they were first-generation immigrants, so he was a first-generation immigrant child. And he wanted to have roots in his fatherland or motherland or whatever they call Switzerland. And so he went to Switzerland and said, I want to have dual citizenship. And apparently in Switzerland, they can kind of domini, you're all Catholic now kind of thing. They can just confer dual citizenship on the entire family. And so that's, he said, fine. And he filled out the forms for that. And Michelle signed her name to it. And so suddenly she was a dual citizen by virtue of being married to a dual citizen. But then she went over to Switzerland and had this whole press conference and thought it was so cool. But then the Republicans in her district was like, you're what? You know, Switzerland's kind of a socialist country. You know, they have a national healthcare system and they have good retirement.
I thought she was giving up the U.S.
No, she never intended to leave the United States. But what has happened is that her children now, if they don't like the United States or if they want a country that has national health insurance, they can head over to Switzerland. Yeah, they're Swiss citizens. It's kind of cool.
Also, another thing I heard was that Mark Zuckerberg, they were talking about his birthday and how he's going to be...
Today is his birthday.
He's
28, I think.
He went public with the stock, and all of a sudden he's this multi-billionaire. And they were saying that I heard on the news, I could swear I heard on the news last night, that Mark Zuckerberg plans on leaving the country too.
No, it's the guy who loaned him $15,000 when they were college roommates Facebook, a guy by the name of Eduardo Saverio.
Only his partner.
Yeah, only his partner. Now, Mark is going to evade taxes in a big way, and so is Facebook, by virtue of another loophole brought to you courtesy of the Reagan administration. Again, pre-Reagan, it was illegal to compensate CEOs or executives with stock options. If you gave, you know, if you wanted to pay them, you had to pay them, and it was a taxable event right at that moment. And Reagan had this idea, or at least the geniuses who surrounded him, this idea that why don't we make the CEOs owners in the company, and that way they'll be interested in the interests of the stockholders.
I would think that would happen.
Well, it did happen, and that's the problem, is that the CEOs are more concerned about the stockholders than they are about the company. They're more concerned about the stockholders than they are about the employees. They're more concerned about the stockholders than they are about the customers.
Okay.
They're more concerned about the stockholders than they are about the wealth of and the health of the nation. And so,
you would think that the stock would go up. Like, for instance, if I want to buy, they would want to make GE a really great product, better than Whirlpool, so that I'm going to run out and buy a GE washer.
At the micro level, they think that way, but the CEOs are not looking at that. The CEOs are looking at what kind of accounting tricks can we do this quarter to show a high profit. How can we crank down our taxes?
And that's the only thing that makes the stock go up.
Yeah, because that it drives up the stock. By and large, it's the main thing that drives the stock up. I mean, it would be wrong to say that good products don't. I think Apple's a great example of that.
Yeah.
You know, good products definitely drive up stock because they drive sales. But that's not that historically that hasn't been the province of the CEOs. That's been way down the food chain with the designers and producers. Apple's the exception. Steve Jobs stuck his nose in that kind of business. And
well,
I was
mostly interested in people in the multi-billionaires leaving the country. I was wondering. I was on the one hand, I'm thinking, well, au revoir. But on the other hand, I'm thinking, what on earth is going on? Do they know something we don't?
Yeah, well, what they know is that this country is having the same thing done to it that Bain Capital did to company after company, and that is that 30 years of Reaganomics has run a pump and dump cycle. They're wringing us dry. They have, and Monica, thank you very much for the call. They have wiped out the middle class. They've gone after the middle class and said, where's the last little bit of money we can get? Okay, let's just throw them into a debt, you know, home debt, car debt, credit card debt. We're going to take it all. And they took it all. I mean, it used to be the middle class in this country actually had equity. It actually had wealth. Not so much anymore. Tim in Warrenville, Illinois. Hey, Tim, what's up?
Hi. A couple of things. I was watching them at SNBC a little bit ago, and they said Romney's ahead 2 percentage points with women. How can that be? And then
because they're uninformed.
Okay.
I mean, you know, most Americans have no idea who Mitt Romney is right now. They're really not paying attention, and they won't start paying attention until October.
And when President Obama is talking about the economy and the unemployment level, why doesn't, or any of the top Democrats, why don't they say, well, yeah, it's, let's say it's 8.1 now, but if you were to pass the jobs bill, it would be this. If you would quit messing with the postal service, it would be this.
Yep.
If the Republicans would quit restricting money to all the states, it would be this.
Yes.
If you were to pass the infrastructure bill, it would be this.
They need to be I absolutely agree with you. The Democrats need to be messaging like that, and it makes me crazy that they're not. For example, John Boehner had just came out yesterday afternoon. It's in this morning's news. That there's going to be a new budget, you know, that we're hitting up against the budget ceiling, the debt ceiling, rather. And so we've got to raise the debt ceiling by congressional mandate. This is not something, by the way, that the Constitution requires. This is something that the Congress just decided to do back in the 1950s, always require an act of Congress to raise the debt ceiling. And it was, you know, conservatives who pushed this thing. And so they're going to raise the debt ceiling. And Boehner is saying, okay, whatever the increased amount of debt is, we're going to have to cut government spending by more than that, which means that what he's looking at doing is instantly this summer, as a consequence of this negotiation, forcing the government to cut spending to the point that 1.8 million people will lose their jobs in the United States. That's the best estimate of independent economists. And so, you know, what they're trying to do is crash the economy. 1.8 million people lose their jobs. It's going to be a lot of pain. It's going to raise the unemployment level. So, Tim, thank you for the call. But, you know, I think you're absolutely right. David, in must be in the Chicago area, listening to WCPT. What's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Good.
This Eduardo Severin departure, mm-hmm. I would just say don't let the door hit you on the way out. This really is a cautionary tale of why the current legislation, proposed legislation by Jerry Moran of Kansas and Senator Mark Warner is such a bad idea regarding the Startup Act. Basically, a rehash of an attempted bill excoriatingly exposed in February of 2000 by the Baltimore Sun, the Startup Visa, where the idea was you let foreign workers or foreigners come in here, let them bring their own capital or get venture capital, they start a business. And
that's what this guy did. This guy was Brazilian. He was going to college at Harvard. He put up $15,000 to start Facebook.
And they want to even legalize this even more with the Startup Act. And let me read you what Walter Roche said in February of 2000 when he wrote a story called INS Insiders Profit on Immigrant Dreams.
Right. We have a basic ban on reading. If you could just summarize it for me,
well,
I'd appreciate it.
This is what Father Hesburgh, who sat on the then Immigration Committee, said. He said, it smacked of being able to buy citizenship.
Of course.
I was the only one who voted against it. And John Bryant, a Texas Democrat, said, this provision is an unbelievable departure from our tradition of cherishing our most precious birthright as Americans. Have we no respect as a nation?
Yeah.
Are we so broke we have to sell our birthright?
I got it, David, and I'm with you on that. And you know, I don't know what to add to it. In fact, it was very well said. Bill in Phoenix, Arizona. Hey, Bill, thanks for listening to KPHX. What's up?
Hey, Tom. You know, whenever you get these fake libertarians on here who have never read Adam Smith or the Constitution, it always drives me nuts.
Well, I would submit that Adam Smith wasn't actually a libertarian. If you've ever read his theory of moral sentiments, Adam Smith is probably to the left of Harry Reid.
Well, but they quote Adam Smith in their free market.
They quote one sentence out of Adam Smith, yeah.
Right, exactly. But they've never even read it because in there he specifically states that any company that, or any person who goes to the government for favor is therefore, you know, biasing what's going on. And corporations, by their very nature, go to the government and ask for favors. They ask for limited liability. They ask for tax, you know, privileges. They ask for all these things that you can't have a free market when you are a corporation.
Well, you can't have a free market, period. There's no such thing as a free market. Markets are created by governments. It's like saying you can't have a free book. Let's have a free football game. What are you going to do?
Right,
okay,
exactly.
No stadium, no referees, no rules. That's a free football game. It doesn't make any sense. Just like a free economy, right. A free market doesn't make any sense.
The other thing is, you know, corporations were the ones who were originally meant to be taxed in our tax code, along with the state taxes.
Starting with Abraham Lincoln, by the way. In a big way. Yes, absolutely. Although Lincoln also increased or created an income tax on individuals. But, Bill, excellent point. Thank you for calling and making it. 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Hey, we just upgraded our free iPhone and iPad app, and it's got the new cool graphics for the iPad, the Super iPad. Check it out in the App Store. Exposing the con and conservative. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, TalkRadioNews.com, brought to you by GoatsForTheOldGoat.com. On the line with us. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's up in the world today?
Well, in the world, away from us overseas, Rebecca Brooks, who used to be in charge of Rupert Murdoch's British newspaper empire and also is pretty pally with Prime Minister David Cameron, goes riding with him and all kinds of things like that, was formally charged today, along with her husband and four other people, of perverting the course of justice in the phone hacking scandal that has rocked Britain.
Now, is perverting the course of justice a fancy way of saying she lied?
That would be a different charge. What she's accused of doing is concealing material from police officers, removing seven boxes of material from the archive of News International. She also conspired to conceal documents, computers, and other electronic equipment from Scotland Yard that bore on the continuing police investigations into phone hacking and corruption of public officials. I mean, she literally, according to what has been reported, was seen carrying boxes of documents out to a car.
Wow. This is like conspiracy to conceal a crime, basically.
Right, exactly, conspiracy. Now, she's also was arrested twice by Scotland Yard, once last year on suspicion of phone hacking and corruption, and then again in March on the perversion of justice case. So it's possible that charges could still be laid in the phone hacking and corruption case, but they haven't been at this time. She could get life for this, or she could get a few years, or she could get a few months.
Wow. And a lot of that's going to depend on how well politically connected she is, maybe?
I don't think political connection is going to come into it. This case is going to go forward in the Old Bailey.
Uh-huh.
This is going to be a big case. She's issued a very combative statement saying she's baffled. It's an expensive sideshow, a waste of public money. It's weak and unjust decision. No, I don't think that I would be very surprised if politics comes into this. The kind of judges that you generally get in the Old Bailey on a case like this is somebody who is going to pride himself on his independence. Hmm. What I think you're going to get is a extremely vigorous defense from her and her racehorse trainer husband and a very vigorous prosecution.
Yeah. Oh, fascinating. Okay. So what else is up?
Also today, the FBI has begun a preliminary inquiry into J.P. Morgan Chase's $2 billion trading loss.
Mm-hmm.
They're going to be examining J.P. Morgan's accounting practices of public disclosures about the trades that prompted the loss. Now, they're saying it is routine for the Justice Department to open a case after such a big blunder, and nobody's been accused of wrongdoing yet. Nevertheless, this is just a few days after it turns out that the SEC has opened an inquiry. Now, the SEC has a lower bar to bring than federal prosecutors, but both inquiries are likely to look at their regulatory filings that mention the internal unit that placed the trades, as well as recent statements from the firm's top executives, including that one of Jamie Dimon in early April, when he publicly played down the concerns, calling them a complete tempest in a teapot,
right,
at a time when it's looking more and more likely he knew looking likely that he might have known that it wasn't a tempest in a teapot.
So Jamie Dimon was lying to us. What a shock.
That's what it's looking like it could be a possibility of.
Yeah, okay.
Also today, J.P. Morgan had its annual shareholders meeting. Jamie Dimon survived a call for him to have his job of CEO and chairman split in two.
Mm-hmm.
The American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees are the ones who said he should resign his post as chairman. Board recommended against. The Board of Pensions for the Presbyterian Church introduced a proposal to ensure more mortgages were modified. Board recommended against that as well.
Whoa, to hell with U.S. mortgage holders, huh? From J.P. Morgan Chase officially. I'm curious whatever happened with Elizabeth Warren's call for him to no longer be a member of the New York Fed. The New York Fed regulates J.P. Morgan Chase. The New York Fed was involved in the decision to hand $300-plus billion to J.P. Morgan Chase during the big bailout. The New York Fed, how is it that he's even on the board of the New York Fed?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Well, what he seems to be saying, I don't have the direct quotation in front of me, but one of the things he says about this, well, really, it's more of an advisory board. That's what he's saying about it.
A board of directors is a board of directors. I mean,
yeah, he's making it sound like it's just a bunch of guys who get together for steak dinners.
Yeah, right. Okay. So he's not stepping down, though.
No, you don't get that impression at all.
All right. What else is up in the world?
Also today, House and Senate Democrats, senior ones, are clashing over whether to bar the military from detaining terrorism suspects on U.S. soil indefinitely. On the one hand, in the blue corner, you've got the Senate Armed Services Chairman Carl Levin saying he's not supporting a proposal from Representative Adam Smith, who's the top Democrat on the House Armed Services Committee, who wants to change the executive branch's power to prevent indefinite detention of suspects on U.S. soil.
Yeah.
So there's quite a big fight going on between the two on this one.
And this is between two Democrats.
Between two Democrats. And the reason it's come up is because the defense authorization bill is being debated in the House this week. And that's one of the big fights that's coming up. You've got a move by certain House Democrats and libertarian-leaning Republicans to introduce language that would stop the executive branch from indefinite detention of people,
enemy combatants
on U.S. soil.
Yes,
enemy combatants.
Yeah.
Carl Levin is saying, no, these are people who have declared war against the U.S. United States. Just because we capture them on U.S. soil does not mean we should not be able to hold them.
Right.
Obama, of course, issued a signing statement last year. Adam Smith says that's not good enough. Doesn't stop another president from not holding people indefinitely.
Well, that's a point to be made. Victoria Jones with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you.
Brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, and Leo Girard on the line with us, the president of the United Steelworkers Union, USW.org, of course, their website. President Girard, welcome back.
Thank you, Tom. Good to be with you.
Great to have you again. The Obama campaign came out yesterday with a 2-minute and a 6-minute version of an ad that was echoed today by the Paul Begala Super PAC in a 30-second ad about GST steel. And then Romney responded to that with an ad about a steel company that Bain Capital had made a small investment in, along with 8 other companies, saying that he made jobs. What's going on here?
Well, I think that Mitt Romney's trying to defend himself against his years of as the governor of Texas, who I thought I'd never quote, Rick Perry called it vulture capitalism. And what you have is that we've got the Bain Capital economic model of going around and acquiring companies for their debt and a little bit of cash, and then as soon as they get that, loading the company up with additional debt, sucking as much money out of the company by paying themselves astronomical fees, dividends, bonuses, every which way you can, and then when the down cycle comes, letting the company fend for itself and go to business. In the case of GST, they cost 750 members of our union and their families. They cost them their jobs. They cost their families son or daughter from not being able to go to college. They destroyed people's retirement income, and they do that. When he goes to the small steel company that he's talking about, they put a pittance of money in with a whole bunch of other people, and that company succeeded because it had nothing to do with Bain Capital's management. Bain Capital just put some money into a company, and to be honest, that's a well-managed steel company, but it's not being managed by Bain Capital.
Right, and the principle, you know, there's a difference between venture capital, which is where you basically, you know, buy some stock in a fledgling company, thus giving that company money that they can build the business with, between doing that and doing something that prior to the Reagan administration was illegal, which is going to a bank and saying, I want to buy this company for $100 million. Please loan the company the money so that the company has to pay back the bank, but give the ownership of that company to me. And this is something that, when and how did this happen? Do you know?
Well, this happened in the mid-90s, and it happened over an extended period of time.
Mm-hmm.
It was the same business model that they used in many other parts of the country. You've seen some of the stuff with a company called AMPAD that mm-hmm. they did the same thing to, and we could go through a whole bunch of others they did in different parts of the country. The thing with GST Steel is it was actually a viable steel company that had been operating for a long, long time. And it went through, as the steel industry does, anybody that knows the steel industry, unfortunately, is cyclical. You have up years and down years.
Sure.
Well, these guys loaded this company with so much debt that in the down years, they just said, liquidate it, get rid of it.
Right.
And you know, part of what troubles me so much, Tom, is that we know that these guys took tens of millions, if not hundreds of millions of dollars out of this company, out of their workers' pockets, put it in their pocket, and then you go and you find out that Mitt Romney's made investments or put his investment money in Swiss bank accounts and in the Cayman Islands so he can pay 14% and set up a $100 million trust fund for his kids. What about the kids of those people at GST Steel who didn't get to go to college because Mitt Romney and Bain Capital systematically, knowingly, deliberately destroyed their chance of having a good, decent family-supporting job?
Yeah, and that's not the only company that they've done it to. I mean, I watched them do it to Clear Channel.
Yeah.
And
you know, that's what the president is trying to sort of confront when he's saying that manufacturing is the future, that we have to give companies take away tax breaks for companies going offshore. I mean, doing these kind of things.
Right.
And I just can't accept that the American people are going to elect a guy who destroys jobs and then takes his money and invests it in offshore bank accounts.
One of the questions that I was asking at the very beginning of this show 2 hours ago was that given the popularity of Mitt Romney right now in the opinion polls, I mean, the New York Times actually has him 2 points ahead of the president, and given this reality of how he made his hundreds of millions of dollars and continues to, I mean, you know, continues to pull $10, $20, $30 million a year. How can this message break through? Is it that Americans aren't listening? Is it that they don't pay attention until October? Is it that, or is it that, you know, that I forget who said it. It was one of fairly high profile media cynic who said, that, you know, European working class people know that they're working class. American working class people believe that they're temporarily inconvenienced millionaires, and so they tend to side with the party that is in favor of the millionaires.
Well, look, I think in America, everybody's conditioned that if you work hard and play by the rules, you can be this huge economic success. And if you go back almost to Jimmy Carter, certainly to Ronald Reagan, if you go through that period of time, we've had this huge onslaught of people being told that the future of America was in financial services and other services, and manufacturing was blasé. It's the old school. Only to find out that You can't create real wealth unless you make things, and you make things through manufacturing things, and the kind of opportunities that we let happen for the Bain Capitals of the world, where they could become, as Rick Perry said, vulture capitalists. Even when a Rick Perry says that this is vulture capitalism and this should not be the kind of capitalism that America stands for, then I think one of our problems, Tom, is we have to get that message out to what many people call the low information voters. Yeah. And that doesn't mean they're bad people. I mean, that means these are people that get up in the morning real early, find their way to work, maybe work 8, 10, 12 hours, not making a lot of money, come home, two husband and wife both working, got to take care of the kids, family. They don't have time for this stuff every day in and day out the way I do or the way you do.
Yeah.
And our objective has to be to get the message out to those people. Take Obamacare. I'm proud that the Republicans call it Obamacare. Is it the health care bill I wanted? Absolutely not. But it's the health care bill that the president and the Democrats fought for over the objection of a right-wing filibuster in the Senate. And guess what? The donut hole is closed for seniors. Kids that are born with a pre-existing condition, their parents will be able to get them health care. Health insurance companies that didn't spend enough on health care but spent too much on dividends and corporate CEOs have to pay back almost $1.5 billion. Students that are going off to school, the parents don't have to worry that the kid could trip and break his leg and not be able to get health insurance and maybe have to quit school. We've done all those things. On top of that, the president is fighting to have student loans be at 3% plus interest versus 6% plus interest. And the Republicans are saying, no, we want the kids to pay 6%. The president is trying to say we need to have the rich pay their fair share. You know, Mitt Romney puts his money in that he made out of the GSTs and the AMPADs and Swiss and
Cayman
offshore
Islands
bank accounts, and doesn't want to pay his fair share. Well, my secretary and I pay 30%, or the people that lost their jobs at GST Steel, they pay their 30%. What the hell is wrong with this?
Yeah.
I mean, the president's fighting for a fair economy for all so that we all get to share in the prosperity that America's creating.
Yeah, and this is the problem, is that I don't think that most Americans get that dynamic that you just so brilliantly described. And
I just saw, excuse me for interrupting, but I just saw something yesterday, and I was...
We just have about 30 seconds, sir.
Okay, I saw something yesterday that said the Fortune 500 companies had the highest collective profit level in the last 10 years, $865 billion. The stock market is higher than it was prior to the economic collapse. All that happened because the president's fighting for jobs, not because we've allowed the Republican agenda to take hold again.
Yeah, yeah, we don't need austerity here. Leo Girard, the president of the United Steelworkers Union, USW.org. President Girard, thank you so much for being with us again.
Sorry for being so long-winded.
No, you did perfect. You did perfect. The breaks I have no control over. They start when they start. Thank you so much for being with us.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So what is it with Americans that they identify with their oppressors?
You major dough through the LBO and fire people en masse. And when asked about the jobs destroyed, you deftly took a pass. And you just said you were proud of your money, proud of your money, and you're so vain. You think you can avoid all your taxes.
You're so vain. You know, I wonder if this is still going to have any juice in November. We will see. David in Detroit, listening to WDTW. Hey, David, what's up?
As I told your screener, I'm actually from Denver doing some business in Detroit.
Mm-hmm.
I heard an expression used. It's all about manufacturing. And it's a mistaken a concept. It's not about manufacturing. It's all about engineering and science. That leads to manufacturing. And when you lose your grip in the sciences and in engineering, you most definitely lose your grip in the manufacturing sector.
Yeah, I don't disagree. It's you need all of them.
Oh, absolutely. But one leads to the other.
Well, and, yes and no. The theory that's been operating in the United States since the Reagan administration is we can do the engineering here, we can do the science here, we can do the manufacturing in cheap labor countries, and everything will work out. What's happening is that those cheap labor countries are starting to do their own science and engineering and telling us to take a hike.
Without question, I own a manufacturing company and a product development company, and we see our intellectual property being taken to foreign nations all the time. Some that out and out copy it. I'm in the medical device field, and the intellectual property that we're creating here that is quite frankly saving lives and reducing medical costs is being taken overseas, and that's the other component that really gets down to the crux of the healthcare issue. Healthcare control doesn't happen in Washington. It happens on the it happens in the product development area, creating new and lesser expensive means to perform procedures and to save lives. Mm-hmm. And when you don't support basically the development cycles, like in a down economy, people recognize that companies cut product development during lean times and focus on getting product out. And what happens when the economy turns around is these same companies are caught without brand new products. I personally don't mind because I sell them our services to help them recover from that mistake. Mm-hmm. And companies make it every day of the week. But the point I wanted to make is, once again, there are foundations like the Kern Family Foundation out of Wisconsin. I'm just familiar with them through a colleague that donate tens of millions of dollars to schools, colleges promoting entrepreneurship and engineering. Mm-hmm. And that's the type of stuff that's going to lead to true manufacturing sector growth.
Well, I think it's also a matter of changing our trade policies. We have a trade policy right now that is not at all competitive, and we're competing with countries that have aggressive and competitive trade policies. So,
yes, that's true. I think, unfortunately, the truth of the matter is the majority of the Americans recognize that I know, and that's not the majority of Americans, but the people I know recognize this trade imbalance but don't have any problem shopping with their wallet instead of their conscience.
Right.
And,
it shouldn't be a matter of conscience. It should be a matter of law.
You can't mandate competency, you can't mandate honesty, and you can't mandate the integrity that you should have.
No, but what you can do is you can say if you take your manufacturing overseas, it's going to cost you more money than if you do manufacturing here because of the nature of the tax code that we're going to charge an import tax on imported goods, tariffs. And once you do that, moral people and immoral people alike are going to change their behavior. They're going to start manufacturing in the United States.
Well, the component that really drives that, though, is the awareness and the conscious awareness that you are actually shopping and voting for your neighbor or voting for the government you support. I mean, we all know that China is a communistic country that operates in a capitalistic economy. And it's a very interesting model they have, and it's very easy to pick on the government and the government's
state-run capitalism. They have all the power of the state, and they have all the power of capitalism.
Exactly.
It's working out very well
exactly.
for them. Thank you very much.
It is right now, but they'll become socially conscious of the fact that they also have the same issues we have, and they'll grow into their public policies that change their economic structure.
Yeah, I think you're right.
But right now, we are their biggest customer. They are becoming their own biggest customer, but we are currently their biggest customer.
Right.
And when you think of
Europe is number
in
two.
Those terms, exactly. And we should demand more of the company and insist that they do what Japan did, quite frankly, move some sectors here, move some entities here, and really actually start building on our shores. You know, I don't want to take all your time, but I did just as an exercise. I scratched my head when I was looking at Kia cars the other day. I was driving down the road, and I'm an automotive nut. And I looked at the Kia, and I said, you know, how did they become what they are so quickly? What was it that led them to this propulsion into a fine product line in a very short period of time? And, of course, as you know, it wasn't by accident. They were promoted by Ford.
Right.
Ford invested in Kia. General Motors invested heavily in South Korea. And what they did was turn around, use the intellectual property that they...
plus South Korea aggressively supports manufacturing. I mean, in 1965,
right.
You know, the average income of a South Korean was less than $700 a year. Their principal export was human hair. And when General Park I believe was his name, you know, did his military coup, the first thing he did was he said, we're going to have an industrial policy here. They made it so that if you smoked foreign cigarettes, you were shunned. I mean, foreign products were just basically banned from their shores. So they immediately created a domestic market for their products, and they jump-started all these companies, including in particular Samsung and Samsung. And so, you know, that's a pretty ferocious competitor. But, David, excellent point. Thank you for the call, and thank you for making it. I believe that if we don't get serious about our trade policies in this country, and this is a problem that transcends both political parties, if we don't get serious about our trade policies and about protecting and bringing manufacturing back to the United States, we are toast. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Up next, the good, the bad, and the very, very ugly. 27 minutes past the hour. The good, the bad, and the very, very cacistogenously ugly. Learn a new word every day here. The good! Chuck Hagel. Hagel, the former Republican senator from Nebraska, attacked his party in an interview with Foreign Policy magazine. He said that the Republican Party, quote, is in the hands of the right. I would say the extreme right more than ever before, end quote. Hagel went on to say, quote, Reagan wouldn't identify with this party. There's a streak of intolerance in the Republican Party that scares people. Intolerance is a very dangerous thing in a society because it always leads to a tragic ending, end quote. Hopefully, Hagel's comments will influence Republicans to stop playing games and help America get back on track. But don't hold your breath. The bad. Wisconsin conservative Supreme Court justices. In the past few years, three of Wisconsin's four conservative Supreme Court justices have been charged with ethics violations. With these charges in mind, all four of the conservative judges voted against reappointing the chair of Wisconsin's Judicial Commission, who is responsible for filing ethics charges. Bad enough that these crooked judges are still on the bench in Wisconsin, but now they've managed to corrupt the judicial system even more. What does it say about our society when those who are supposed to uphold the law continually break it? And the very, very ugly, Rince Priebus. Despite J.P. Morgan Chase losing a whopping $2 billion from risky trading, Republican Party Chairman Priebus thinks Wall Street needs less financial regulation. In an interview over the weekend, Priebus made it clear that Republicans still oppose the types of regulations that would have prevented J.P. Morgan's losses and protected both American taxpayers and the American economy. It's clear that Wall Street has absolutely no control over its own actions and needs regulations, but Priebus wants to let the big banks continue their destruction of the American economy, and that is very, very ugly. That's mind-bogglingly ugly. Here's Rince Priebus, in fact, clip number two. This is Rince Priebus talking about that.
Think we need less financial regulation rather than more?
I think we need less. I mean, the fact of the matter is Dodd-Frank didn't work.
Well, that could be because Dodd-Frank isn't fully in force. I mean, duh! Of course, you know, expecting the head of the Republican Party to be logical. I don't know. Randy in Seattle. Hey, Randy, thanks for listening to Talk 1090. What's up? Randy? No, Randy. Okay. Wally in Redmond, Oregon. Hey, Wally, what's on your mind?
Hey, I'll take Randy's time.
Okay. No, you got
listen,
it.
I really appreciate your show and the fact you mentioned oligarchy really rings true because I think we do have a one-party system. I mean, Obama got elected because Bush screwed the whole country up, and so a Democrat was finally elected. But then the rich put everybody in place, and their goal was to basically just take anything they could away from him and not support him in any way.
Well, yes and no. You had actually a couple of years where Nancy Pelosi produced some really good legislation. I mean, there was a law that came out of the House of Representatives that would have brought back manufacturing to the United States. It got filibustered in the Senate by Republicans. There was a law that would...
Yes, well, what I'm saying is...
There's over 220 laws like that.
They've made it a point to make it a one-party system by by filibuster and whatever means it takes. But I wanted to briefly put it in historical perspective, why people are ignorant and why they voted against themselves, okay?
Sure.
There have been only two Democrats elected since 1976, Jimmy Carter and Barack Obama.
What about Bill Clinton?
Bill Clinton was elected, but he got in by mistake because Ross Perot was running. And,
you know,
and that was the only reason.
I'm not sure that's true. I think that Ross Perot probably pulled more from the Republicans than he did from the Democrats. His number two guy was, you know, Admiral Stockton.
Well, that's what I mean.
He
pulled from the Republicans. Yeah. So Bill Clinton got in.
So
I'm saying only two Democrats have been elected since 76.
Well, it's like saying, you know, Bush was not elected in 2000 or 2004 because there's questions.
Well, I didn't want to make that the main issue, but I was trying to say, you know, when Johnson did the civil rights, he knew he was going to lose the South in the voting, and he did.
Right.
And now the South votes Republican every time.
Yeah.
And so, but from that point forward, there's been a media campaign. I mean, and from the 70s forward, when Reagan took power, there's been a media campaign to make the right wing prominent
sure,
voice.
Because the right wing has been, ever since 73, when Lewis Powell's memo started getting acted upon by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and he got put on the Supreme Court by Nixon, and then, of course, 81, Reagan takes power, we have seen this steady increase in consolidation in the media, big corporations running the media, and the interests of big corporations and the interests of right wingers are generally the same.
Yeah, and I wanted to point out a book for people. It was called The Republican Noise Machine by David Brock. You've probably read it. It's a very important book, and it talks from the 70s forward how they made a concerted effort to really slant this toward the right. And white people, the reason people vote against themselves, they watch mainstream media. And there are only like three medias that tell the truth. You, Current TV, MSNBC, those three.
Yeah.
I can't think of any others. But anyway, the rest of them is propaganda. And that book by David Brock will clarify why things went the way they did, and why people are getting information which is really nothing.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And David Brock knew it because he was in the middle of it. He was part of that.
And I think it is an oligarchy because that's the way they planned it, that's the way they want it, and that's the way it is right now. And even the Democrat getting in has a hell of a time getting anything done.
Yep, well said.
Because it is one party. I think we have one party now.
Well, we have one party that is exercising a rule that's way beyond the Constitution, and this is why Bob, and thanks for the call, Wally. This is why Bob Edgar of Common Cause has come out and said, we are going to sue the United States Senate because the Constitution says that a law is passed when a majority of senators vote for it. And there's been a majority of senators, there's 100 senators in total. There's been more than 50 votes for a lot of laws. This year, last year, the year before that, and in every single case, the Republicans said, no, we won't allow it to be passed because we will not allow the vote to happen because we're going to stop at the point of the vote to end the debate, which has to happen before you can actually have the vote. And that's called a filibuster. And filibusters used to be rare and few and far between, and they used to be reserved for really, really big deals. And now they're pretty much everything, which is just wrong. Paul in Chicago. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hi. Well, your last caller pretty much said a lot of what I was thinking. Long before Citizens United, a culmination in the disaster, I think back in the 70s, certain Republican thinkers, like I think Newt Gingrich included, decided or came to the conclusion that they had to get control of the media.
Oh, yeah.
And they set about doing it, and they've been successful.
Yeah.
And what they couldn't get control of, they would neutralize with advertising dollars.
Yeah, this was Lee Atwater's strategy back during the Reagan years. Was
right.
He called it play the refs.
Well, I thought I discovered something. No,
the media are the referees of civil debate and discourse.
Yeah.
And so he said, let's play the refs. And that started, you know, Brent Bozell, you know, with money from the billionaires, started this whole accuracy in media or whatever it was, and you know, calling out every time that they thought there was the slightest hint of unfairness toward the Republicans. And so the media just became, you know, hypersensitive, afraid basically of these bullies. And right. it's still there. I mean, you know, to the point now that, you know, David Gregory of Meet the Press is going out and being the lead name in a big fundraising, you know, big hoop-de-doop that Karl Rove is speaking at, you know, for Republican think
tank. I remember when Meet the Press was a good program.
Yeah. Yeah, it's
you
been
remember
it's
those days?
I do, and it's dating both of us, Paul, because yeah. it's been a hell of a long time, and this again is because of this media consolidation that, you know, brought to us courtesy of Reagan. So thanks a lot for the call,
exactly right.
Paul. By the way, I just wanted to point out before Citizens United that that you can draw a pretty straight line from this stuff. In 73, Nixon put Lewis Powell on the Supreme Court. In 72 or 73, he wrote that memo to his next door neighbor and friend, the head of the U.S. Supreme or the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and said, you know, business in America is under attack. It's under attack from Ralph Nader, who just published Unsafe at Any Speed, about the auto industry, and Rachel Carson, who wrote Silent Spring. You know, the pesticide industry and the auto industry were both under attack. And he was like, you know, we have to fight back. And to fight back, we have to take the media. We have to take the educational institutions. We have to take the courts. And out of that came the Federalist Society for the courts and, you know, the absolute effort to consolidate the media. Then Powell got put on the Supreme Court in the 70s. Then Powell participated in a decision called Buckley versus Vallejo that basically said that it was the precursor to the money is speech pitch. And then in the 80s, there was another decision, another seminal decision, that these two decisions set up Citizens United. And this one was called First National Bank versus Bilotti. It used to be in Massachusetts. There was a law that said that a bank couldn't spend money on a political campaign unless it had to do with banking. And there was a bank that was spending money on, I believe it was an issue, whatever it was. It had nothing to do with banking. And so Frank Bilotti, the state attorney general, prosecuted the bank. This went all the way to the Supreme Court. Supreme Court said, oh, no, bank is a person. It's a corporation. They can spend money on whatever they want. These two decisions, the first establishing money as speech in Buckley versus Vallejo, the second establishing corporations as people with rights under the First Amendment in First National Bank versus Bilotti in the 70s and the 80s, while Lewis Powell was on the court. These, and he was very influential on the court. He's since deceased, but these decisions set the whole thing up. And I think, Paul, this is the genesis. This is really where it started. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Do you agree with Republicans who write in the Wall Street Journal that this guy who's leaving the country to avoid taxes is an American hero? You think? So why does Mitt Romney want to be president? There's a fascinating article over at addictivenews.com and addictinginfo.org, excuse me. And it says Romney wants to be president to fulfill a cult prophecy. When Mitt Romney received his patriarchal blessing as a Michigan teenager, he was told that the Lord expected great things from him. All young Mormon men, the so-called worthy males of the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, receive such a blessing as they embark on their requisite journey as religious missionaries. But at 19 years of age, the youngest son of the most prominent Mormon in American politics, a seventh-generation direct descendant of one of the faith's founding 12 apostles, Mitt Romney had been singled out as a destined leader. The Cougar Club, the all-male, all-white social club at Brigham Young University in Salt Lake City, blacks were excluded from full membership of the Mormon Church until 1978, was humming with talk that the Cougar Club's president, Mitt Romney, would become the first Mormon president of the United States. If not Mitt, then who? Was the ubiquitous slogan within the elite organization. The pious world of Brigham Young University was expected to spawn the man who would lead the Mormons into the White House and fulfill the prophecy of the church's founder, Joseph Smith, which Romney has avidly sought to realize. And Joseph Smith, of course, said that a Mormon would someday become president of the United States, and that's when Jesus is going to come back and all these cool things are going to happen. What is going on with this? 866-987-THOM, our telephone number, John in Albuquerque. Hey, John, thanks for listening to KABQ. What's up?
Thanks. I wonder why the Democrats haven't pulled the nuclear option in the Senate, you know, and didn't get rid of the filibuster at the beginning of this session.
They should have done it 3 years ago. Yeah. Harry Reid last week came out and said, I made a mistake. I should have changed the rules of the Senate when I took power at the, you know, every 2 years, there's that little 5-minute window where they can change the rules of the Senate. And in January of the election year, even the midterm elections. And he said, you know, I should have done it in 2010 when, you know, in January of 2011, actually. After the 2010 elections,
are they just being collegial, or are they afraid of losing the majority and, you know, losing any power?
It's both.
In the next round,
it's both. They're very afraid of losing the majority.
So discouraging.
They're very afraid of losing the majority, and they have been thinking, you know, one of these days these Republicans will start, you know, behaving like normal people, and it's a misguided fantasy. Thanks a lot for the call, John. I appreciate it. John, Charles in Houston, Texas. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Oh, about the same as always, but I noticed one thing that back when Michael Moore did a few of his little programs and stuff, then back when Howard Dean was doing the 50-state program, that we were supposed to get people who had Democrat by their name into office.
Yeah.
And what was supposed to happen then was when we got to the off-presidential election, we were supposed to then primary out those blue dog Democrats and put in more progressive ones.
What happened
to
a few of
them? Well, now we're back at the same boat again because it didn't happen.
Well, but half... No. What you're missing, Charles... Charles, what you're missing is that half of the blue dogs lost their seats in the 2010 election. Half of them. So, you know, a couple of them lost their seats to progressives. Most of them lost their seats to Republicans. And that's the danger of the blue dogs. That's the fine... And thanks for the call. That's the fine line that they walk, which is... That, you know, most of them are coming out of Republican districts where they've got to take a few of the Republican points of view in order to get elected. And what we really need is to stop gerrymandering in this country. We need to pass a law that says that when congressional districts are drawn, that they can't look like a salamander, that when congressional districts are drawn, they have to have no more than 6 sides or 7 sides and be... I forget the word in geometry. Does anybody remember? What's the word for a geometric shape that's roughly the same in all directions or dimensions? There's some obscure geometric word for it. But quadrilateral, I think. Maybe that's it. It's been a long time since I had geometry. But that's what we need to say, is basically they've got to be squares or octagons or hexagons, but they can't be salamander-shaped. And then you'll have Congress people who actually represent the vast majority of the people rather than these narrow constituencies. Joe in Canton, Ohio. Hey, Joe, what's up?
I just wanted to remark there before the news break, there was a gal on there speaking to some women's association. I was struck with the naivete of the younger people. I'm 55. I've kind of seen a lot of stuff go through the Reagan years. I agree. Everything started with Ronald Reagan. And just the naivete, and I think we need to get trade tariffs up, and we need to get the money out of politics.
Yep.
I was in New Zealand quite a few years ago, and one thing that I noticed there on their import stuff is they wouldn't allow anything that could be easily made within the borders of New Zealand to be imported without a 60% import tariff put on.
Yeah, this is what every other country in the world has figured out, a way to protect their manufacturing industry. The United States is not. Excellent point, Joe. Thanks for calling and making it. Bobby in Levittown, New York. We have less than a minute, Bobby. Your point?
Hi, I was wondering why you were attacking Romney's faith when, you know, clearly Obama's a Muslim.
You're joking, right?
No, I'm not joking. Have you seen the pictures of him with a turban, or he ate dog? You know, you ever read any of this stuff?
you really believe this? Yeah, he went over to Kenya and he put on a turban and they took one photo. I mean, and he wrote in his autobiography that when he lived in Indonesia, as most Indonesians do, he was served dog once and he didn't like it. How does either of those things make him a Muslim?
Listen, first of all, he sides with the Muslim people. He says that the Israelis should turn to a pre-67 border. Who the hell does he think he is?
I don't think he's saying that, Bobby. And in fact, I know he's not saying that. You really need to get your information from someplace other than like one of the white supremacist sites. Coming up next on the Tom Hartman Program, President Obama made history again last week, this time for supporting marriage equality. Right-wingers have been having a field day. Is it time they learn to live and let live? I'll confront one of those right-wingers, Dr. Paul Kammer of the Family Research Institute. That and the best of the rest of the news and your calls right here on the Tom Hartman Program. And don't forget, democracy begins with you. When you show up, when you participate, tag, you're it. Get out there and occupy something. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.